Welcome to Outdoor by 4 Magazine's audio edition of Issue 52. For those unfamiliar with Outdoor by 4, the magazine began its journey as a fully independent, vehicle-based adventure and outdoors lifestyle publication in 2013. Since that time, Outdoor by 4 has been the catalyst for expanding the reach of overland and vehicle-based adventure travel into the outdoors market, with a focus not only on the mode of travel, whether a 4x4, motorcycle, bicycle, or by foot, but also on the adventures themselves and the people who live them. In this issue, you'll hear a sampling of stories from Outdoor by 4's print edition, including Deep in the Heart of Texas, Adventure Abounds Along the Lone Star Hiking Trail, The Route of the Hiawatha, Bicycling Along the Stunning Landscapes of the Bitterroot Mountains, A Trail Runs Through It, Following the Brave on Idaho's Oregon and California Trails, and 40 Days in the Desert, A Nomadic Life in Oregon's Public Lands. There are also a variety of additional stories in this issue you can read by picking up a copy or by subscribing and receiving a copy as part of your subscription order at www.outdoorx4.com. We hope you enjoyed this issue of Outdoor by 4 Magazine. The Dispatch by Frank Ludwell, Editor-in-Chief. I was first introduced to the idea of cosplay in the early 2000s and recall feeling a bit conflicted. The idea of mostly grown people costuming themselves as their favorite comic book hero, sci-fi character, or the latest pop icon was not only fascinating to me, but also a bit awkward. It wasn't until years later I began to understand and truly respect the passion enthusiasts felt for the stories and fictitious characters they'd come to rely on as a reprieve from the regularity of normal life. Earlier in the year, Outdoor by 4 hosted a booth at the annual Overland Expo, held over a three-day period in Flagstaff, as we've done for over a decade. If you've never been, the event can feel a bit like a cosplay convention. While the focus is on vehicle-based exploration rather than interstellar travel, the synergies are quite similar. Over-the-top vehicles that are impractical for daily use, hundreds of variants of essential gear you absolutely can't leave home without, vendor booths designed to draw crowds with all sorts of gimmicks to promote their brand, and yes, cosplay. Hundreds, if not thousands, of grown people dressed in the latest tactical gear that fits the look of what an overland traveler rightfully should be, because a YouTube channel they saw suggests that's what vehicle-based exploration requires. Not to mention the volume of four-legged friends trying to remain calm whilst caught in the anxiety-filled expanse of what I'm sure they perceive as the level of Dante's Inferno. All this to say, it's easy to feel a bit conflicted. Of course, the event isn't completely the circus it sounds to be. Beneath the expansive shroud lined with Benjamins is, at its core, opportunities to inspire those who know nothing of vehicle-based exploration who desire to learn more. A myriad of seminars, roundtable discussions, a film festival, and happy hour events throughout the weekend still provide an element of community that complements the fascination of the event's facade. Despite my perceptions of how the event has evolved, Overland Expo continues to be a fascination. Each spring, as enthusiasts from all over the world descend upon Flagstaff, the event undoubtedly offers a reprieve from regularity. Expo provides a three-day break from normal life behind a desk, from home and its responsibilities, and from the real world. Maybe, at the end of the day, that's the whole point.
This audio edition of Outdoor by 4 is brought to you by Radius Outfitters. We all know how messy life and vehicles can get. That's why Radius offers rugged storage systems that protect and organize your essentials. From customizable storage boxes to kitchen organizers, Radius gear makes life at camp easier, so you'll be ready for anything, whether cruising with the family in the desert or kicking it solo in the mountains. Check them out today by visiting radiusoutfitters.com.
Deep in the heart of Texas, adventure abounds along the Lone Star Hiking Trail. Words and Photos by Retha Charette. I slid my foot out of my soggy trail runners, I could feel my heartbeat pulsing in my pinky toe. Once I peeled off my toe sock liners, I saw the white, mushy bubble in all its disgusting glory, sticking out like a sixth toe off my right foot. Considering this was only my first day along the Lone Star hiking trail, this was not a good sign. I had 19.7 miles down and 76.7 to go. A month before I grew my new toe, I casually Googled best winter through hikes. I needed to get out of the snow and cold. Living in Vermont provides me great access to the Appalachian Trail, the Adirondacks, and the White Mountains during the summer to hike to my heart's content. But during the winter, I'm an indoor cat. While lounging by the wood stove and après-ski is fun, by February, I'm over it and ready to take my backpack on another adventure. After reading a few articles and discovering that the Lone Star Hiking Trail is north of Houston, where I have several friends, it was decided I was Texas bound. Like any experienced hiker, I started my planning with the most important thing, finding out what could kill me on the LSHT. Turns out there were quite a few things. Coral snakes, water moccasins, copperheads, wild boars, alligators, and chupacabra. I can't confirm that the chupacabra is actually out there, but was told to keep an eye out for it by members of the Lone Star Hiking Trail Facebook group I had joined. As for all the other critters, I either saw them or found evidence of them during my hike. I kept my distance and made it out unscathed, but I was tempted to make friends with a beautiful coral snake. A challenge I hadn't faced on any of my other long-distance hikes was a lack of water. The Appalachian Trail isn't known to be very dry. I read blogs about people dropping water caches at trailheads before getting on trail. The official guidebook discussed long water carries between sources that were murky and full of sediment. Thankfully, Mother Nature smiled upon me, and it rained a lot the week before my hike. I had no issues finding water, and with help from my Sawyer Squeeze water filter, that water was safe to drink. During my trip prep, I did make a couple of mistakes. I got so excited about the hike that I went grocery shopping at my local grocery store. It's like I forgot there were stores in Texas. I still feel really stupid about that. The other big mistake I made happened because I don't usually fly with all my backpacking gear. As a result, I neglected to remove my pocket knife from my first aid kit. When the TSA guy said, "You've got a huge knife in your bag," I was simultaneously embarrassed and angry at myself. I really loved that knife. I hope there's a raccoon at a garbage dump in Albany, New York, making good use of it. Thankfully, I was able to drown my tears in Tex-Mex and margaritas upon arrival in Texas. After the first day of hiking, while I was inspecting my blisters, I could have used another margarita. My feet would have still been in pain, but the icy goodness would have cooled me off. The tequila would have helped, too. I have hiked thousands of miles in my hiking career and have never had blisters that bad, and they were everywhere. I wanted to soak my feet in the lake just behind my campsite, but thought I spotted an alligator. Thinking I'd rather have sore feet than no feet, I climbed into my tent. Using my backpack to elevate my feet and some ibuprofen to dull the pain, I fell asleep listening to the wind and wondering how I was going to make the 18.6 miles I had planned for the next day. Start, stop, start, stop, all day long. I couldn't stay on my feet for very long because my sixth toe kept getting bigger and bigger. Then came the smud. It's not quite sand and it's not quite mud, and I'm not a geologist, so smud it is. It's sandy, sticky, and made me slide for a solid mile and a half. My first step onto the smud, I slipped, tried to use my trekking poles to catch myself, but didn't. I ended up in a half split with one arm in the air, the other jamming my pole into the mud. I felt like a D-list figure skater. Once I got the hang of walking through the smud, it started to cake to the bottom of my shoes. At one point, I think I had grown 2 inches taller. It felt good being that tall until I used my trekking pole to try and get the smud off the bottom of my shoes, which caused me to lose my balance and fall flat on my ass. I was so frustrated that it felt like steam was coming out of my ears. I screamed a word that rhymes with duck at the top of my lungs and set up my tent in the first flat spot I could find. It wasn't even 5 p.m., but I wasn't walking a single step more. My saving grace that night was the Mountain House chicken fajita bowl I had for dinner and my dessert of a Hershey bar with almonds topped with peanut butter. When things get tough on the trail, I try to find my zen. I think that's what makes a long-distance hiker. The ability to make hiking a walking meditation. To tune out the rest of the world and just be on the trail with your thoughts. There are many ways to do this, and not a single right answer. Each hiker needs to find it in themselves. In the mornings, I like to hike and listen to the birds chattering away to each other in the trees. On hot afternoons, it helps to distract myself with an audiobook. I especially love a book series if the trail is really long. The dorkiest thing I do is put on a playlist with the perfect balance of Broadway show tunes and songs from 90s Disney movies. This usually ends with me breaking out into song and dance on the trail. I've been told people get secondhand embarrassment when seeing this, but I couldn't care less. I used these tactics to chill out and turn on the joy I needed to finish my hike. I spent the last 3.5 days of my hike amplifying the positive aspects around me while facing the negative head on. I stopped along the trail more frequently when an area spoke to me and took some time to geocache along the trail. Geocaching is using million-dollar satellites to find Tupperware hidden in the woods. You can learn all about geocaching by checking out issue 4 of Outdoor by 4 magazine. One of the days, I just sat trailside for a while, eyes closed, listening to everything around me. That doesn't mean the remainder of the trail was unicorns and rainbows. When doing the water crossing at the San Jacinto River, I couldn't get out of the water because the bank was steep and muddy. I ended up with my legs covered in mud, a bloody knee, and a wet butt. Thankfully, the river was alligator-free. My last night on the trail was spent trapped in my tent from the time I stopped walking until the next morning due to swarms of blood-sucking mosquitoes. On my last morning after leaving the vampire bug campsite, I heard a barred owl call. One of my random talents is that I'm pretty good at owl calls. I sat down and let out a loud, "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you?" No response. I did the call again, and as I finished, a barred owl landed in a tree 50 yards from me. I did the call one last time, and it humored me by calling back. I'd like to think this was the trail's way of bidding me farewell. Around 10:30 a.m. on March 12th, I reached the Winters Bayou parking lot and completed my thru-hike of the Lone Star Hiking Trail. I climbed atop the roadside sign marking the area, taking in the sun and airing out my feet. An old-timer pulled into the parking lot and proceeded to remove trail maintenance tools from its trunk. We had an exchange, like many lovers of the outdoors do. "Nice day," he said. "How was your hike?" I asked him how long he had been volunteering to do trail cleanup, and he told me over 20 years. Something I don't think gets spoken about enough in the hiking community are the people who make through hiking possible. There are people who have been here before us that made it possible. In the case of the Lone Star Hiking Trail, it started with the Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club. Without their vision to bring more hiking to Texas in the late 1960s, the trail wouldn't be there today. From the trail maintenance volunteers that we may never meet, to the friends and family rooting us on at home, we couldn't have these amazing adventures without their support. As a result, while I did this hike solo, I was never truly alone.
Root of the Hiawatha. Words and photos, Robert Theobald. Nestled amidst the breathtaking beauty of the Bitterroot Mountains lies the Root of Hiawatha, a bicycle trail that embraces the connection with nature and the spirit of adventure. The story of the Hiawatha bike trail is a tale of transformation and resilience, a place where you experience the echoes of a bygone era. It is a recreational trail that invites travelers to explore the stunning landscapes woven into the Bitterroot Mountains of northern Idaho and northwestern Montana. The history of the trail starts over 110 years ago, In the late 19th century, the railroad industry was at the forefront of progress and expansion in the United States. In 1907, the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific Railroad, commonly known as the Milwaukee Road, commenced an audacious venture to connect Chicago to the untamed beauty of the Pacific Northwest. The Milwaukee Road was an ambitious undertaking of a railway line that would traverse the rugged and picturesque Bitterroot Mountains, making its way through to the Pacific Northwest. Building a railroad presented engineers with formidable challenges. The route was marked by steep gradients, deep canyons, and challenging terrain. To work around these foreboding obstacles, the Milwaukee Road engineers employed innovative engineering techniques, including constructing numerous tunnels and awe-inspiring trestles. The most notable engineering marvel along the Milwaukee Road route was the St. Paul Pass Tunnel, also known as the Taft Tunnel. Completed in 1908, this remarkable feat of engineering spanned 1.66 miles through the heart of the Bitterroot Mountains. The tunnel's construction required immense manpower and perseverance, as workers meticulously carved through solid rock to create a long tunnel. The construction of the Milwaukee Road route was an epic endeavor that showcased the ingenuity and determination of the engineers and laborers involved. The Milwaukee Road faced many challenges. One of the most devastating forest fires in American history occurred in 1910, burning nearly 3 million acres of forest in northern Idaho and western Montana. It was so huge that a massive cloud of smoke spread throughout southern Canada and the northern United States all the way to the St. Lawrence Waterway. The darkness from this smoke was so bad that for 5 days, artificial lighting had to be used from Butte, Montana, including Chicago, to Watertown, New York. The fire completely devastated the St. Joe River Valley and destroyed all of the towns except Avery and Marble Creek. Many of these were never rebuilt. Stories were told about train engineers driving the engines and boxcars filled with people through the flames into the tunnels, which ended up saving hundreds of people. As the 20th century progressed, the advent of automobiles, the development of highway infrastructure, and the emergence of air travel ushered in new modes of transportation. The golden age of rail travel gradually waned, and the demand for passenger train services diminished. The route became known as the Route of the Hiawatha because the railroad named their trains the Hiawatha, the Twin Cities Hiawatha, the North Woods Hiawatha, the Chippewa Hiawatha, the Midwest Hiawatha, and the Olympian Hiawatha. The first train, the Twin Cities Hiawatha, was named for the epic poem, The Song of Hiawatha, by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The last passenger train, the Olympian Hiawatha, passed through the Bitterroots in 1961, and the last train west of Butte, Montana, departed in 1980, marking the end of an era. The once thriving Milwaukee Road tracks, which had witnessed the comings and goings of countless trains, were now abandoned. In 1998, the first 13 miles of the old train line were opened to the public as the Route of the Hiawatha Bike Trail. In 2001, the 1.6-mile Taft Tunnel was opened, creating a 15-mile trail that drops a little less than 1,000 feet over its length, making for a relatively easy and scenic ride. On the trail are 10 tunnels and 7 sky-high steel trestle bridges. A few years ago, my wife read about the Route of the Hiawatha and wanted to do the ride. We planned out our vacation to include this as part of our summer adventure. Once we had our vacation dates set, I jumped online to get tickets and rent bikes for the ride. Tickets include a shuttle back up to the end of the Taft Tunnel, so riders experience the 1.6-mile long tunnel twice, once in each direction. We also took advantage of the bike delivery option, so we could just pick up the bikes at the trailhead. We arrived early, so we could get on the trail before the larger crowds got there. While talking with the staff that helps run the trail, they said they can see over 1,000 people a day during the busy season, and usually a few hundred a day during most days throughout the rest of the season. We got our bikes and helmets and headed to the trail. The trail starts at the east portal of the Taft Tunnel. Within minutes, you are in the pitch black, only seeing where your headlight is focused. We had 4 in our group, and it created a nice stream of lights through the tunnel. As we exited the 1.6-mile tunnel, there was a very picturesque little waterfall, where we stopped and took some pictures. Then we continued on. Winding our way through the tall pine trees, through more tunnels and over the trestle bridges, we stopped and read the history placard and stopped to take pictures of the amazing scenery. As we got to the end, we got in line for the shuttle back up. The line for the shuttle can oftentimes take upwards of an hour or two. However, while you wait, you can find a snack vendor, a game of cornhole, and some friendly guides to chat with. You can also leave your bikes in the shuttle line and head over to one of the many picnic tables and have lunch in the shade. Though there were some snacks to buy, I recommend bringing a light lunch or your own snacks to enjoy on the trail or at the end of the trail. We learned some things on the ride. Water seeped through the mountain, so there was mud in the Taft Tunnel that got into everything. All the riders had lines of mud on their back. It was kind of funny. The rental bikes were functional, but they are not fancy. Just your standard, basic mountain bike. They do have an upgrade to a comfort model that has nicer seats and a step-through frame. The trail and the rental bike company are managed by the Lookout Pass Ski Resort, just a few miles away. You can save some money by renting and picking up bikes at the resort. We opted for the delivery to the trailhead as we didn't have a vehicle that would work to transport the bikes to the trailhead. Next time, I would try to bring our own bikes to do some mountain biking in the surrounding areas as well. The Silver Mountain Ski Resort is not too far away and has a mountain bike park as well as rental bikes. We had fun and built memories. There is a lot of history around this trail, and placards on the descent share the history. Stop and read them. Last, there are a lot of cool, small towns both east and west of the trail. The night before the ride, we ended up staying in Kellogg, Idaho, and enjoyed some good food at one of the local restaurants. After the ride, we headed over to Kalispell, Montana, and then on to Glacier National Park. There are also a few ski resorts in the area that have great mountain biking. You really choose your own adventure with all the nearby activities. The route of the Hiawatha is a testament to the remarkable history of the Milwaukee Road Railroad and of the community that brought the abandoned rail line back to life. As adventurers start their journey through the enchanting Bitterroot Mountains, they become a part of the story that intertwines the past and the present, connecting people with nature and the enduring legacy of the Milwaukee Road.
Since 2017, 230 has been a leader in the ever-evolving overland market. Whether it's high-quality products such as rooftop tents, awnings, or a variety of camp life gear, 230 is all about delivering adventure with a made better principle, opting on better products, not cheaper ones. If you're looking for quality gear to get you into the backcountry and back, look no further than 230. Visit them at www.230.com.
A trail runs through it, following the brave on Idaho's Oregon and California trails. Words and photos, Heidi Brandes. Bernard J. Reed was stunned at what he was seeing that sweltering August day in 1849. He, along with a dozen or so other emigrants traveling in covered wagons, had just reached southeast Idaho to follow the gold trail to California in 1849, and challenges, danger, and death seemed to follow the emigrants every step of the journey. After weeks of battling drought, the searing pain of hunger, conflicts with Native American tribes, and watching friends and family fall to disease, southern Idaho's City of Rocks National Reserve must have seemed like a fairy tale land of beauty and respite. Reed spent weeks under a scorching sky in Wyoming, so the Bear Valley and Bear River section of Idaho, leading towards City of Rocks near Alamo, Idaho, was an oasis of water, wild berries, fresh grass, cottonwood trees, and game like elk, deer, and waterfowl. Another 2 miles, we enter a rocky dell, some 4 miles long by a winding road. Running among the most grotesque rocks, standing out single in the valley, or grouped fantastically together, he wrote in his diary, now preserved for more than 100 years. There were sphinxes and statues of every size, and haystacks and wigwams and castles and towers, and pyramids and cones, and projecting turrets and canopies and leaning columns and so on throughout 1,000 varieties of fantastic shapes. On a similar fall morning in September, my adventure buddy Lyle and I stood at that same spot where hundreds of thousands of immigrants traveling the California Trail through Idaho saw their first glimpse of City of Rocks National Preserve. After miles of flat plains with mountains smoky in the distance, to go over a hill to see a landscape of weird towering rocks and formations had to have been mind-blowing. It certainly was for us. In the 10 days we bumped over Idaho's twisting highways and rocky backroads, the specters of those who forged forward, suffered, died, and survived the famed California Gold Trail and Oregon Trail followed us, whispering history into the wind and through the gorges and even the rushing, menacing waters of the river. During the height of Western migration, from America's eastern states to Oregon and California from about 1840 to 1869. More than 300,000 stalwart immigrants traveled the Oregon Trail to claim their own piece of the West. Another 200,000 went to seek their fortune in gold along the California Trail between 1841 and 1869. Of the 2,000 miles of trail stretching from Missouri to the Oregon Territory, 500 miles went through Idaho, perhaps one of the harshest landscapes the immigrants tackled. Besides unforgiving desert landscapes and the fearsome Snake River, the immigrants suffered from rampant disease, lethal river crossings, conflicts, and starvation. The California Trail wasn't much better, though cholera took its toll more severely than on the Oregon Trail. Coming up upon a landscape of stone castles, towering granite mountains, and hundreds of piles, peaks, steeples, and domes must have felt like stepping into a type of Eden. Game abounded, water was clean, and the landscape was gorgeous. We were here to find those same roots and magic that the immigrants discovered. It wasn't hard. We found magic everywhere in Idaho. A Tale of Two Trails. Idaho, where are you? My friend Lyle asked for the umpteenth time since we started our journey through Idaho's southern and central region 3 days prior. Neither of us had been to Idaho. I came because a friend told me once it was one of the last truly wild and untamed places in the lower 48. Lyle came for the Oregon Trail, and a bit of adventure as well. Thanks to the popularity of the series Yellowstone spinoff 1883, which takes place on the Oregon Trail, this westward route that helped shape the West for better or worse has found itself yet again in the spotlight. Unlike Lyle, who had researched and read about the trail for years, I was more ignorant about the history than I cared to admit. I love trailing in the footsteps of the most intrepid bunch of dreamers in American history, Lyle said when I asked him about why he was so into Oregon Trail history. Imagine taking off from a stable homeland into the terrifying unknown of roughage and sagebrush with only the rumors of blue shores in Oregon, or hoping to find gold nuggets the size of a goat's head. That took a lot of bravery and hope. According to the U.S. Forestry Service, the main Oregon Trail from Three Island Crossing to Boise was the primary route used for the first 10 years of the trail. Those immigrants who could not cross the Snake River were forced to follow the south side of the Snake River on a route known as the South Alternate, while the California Trail had several different routes to the West Coast. One led California-bound pioneers through southeast Idaho, while another went from Salt Lake City northward to Idaho to rejoin the main trail at the City of Rocks near Granite Pass. The City of Rocks National Reserve was notable for more than its striking landscapes, now a playground for hikers, campers, and brave-hearted rock climbers. Many migrations split from the Oregon Trail and followed the California Trail here. Once in the City of Rocks, travelers found themselves overwhelmed and impressed by the magnificent granite rock formations around them. They left their mark at places like Register Rock, where they scrawled their name onto the granite in axle grease. A. Freeman, June 1250. T. Tickner, June 1250, the graffiti reads, next to more modern, shameful, garish graffiti from ignorant tourists. I cast my eyes away from the present-day ugly scrawl to wander about. A. Freeman's reasons for leaving his home to brave the Wild West, only to find himself on June 12, 1850, right where I was standing. Ruts in the ground. Somehow, we lost the hiking trail from where we parked our home on wheels at the Twin Sisters campsite at City of Rocks. named for two giant granite formations that served as a landmark along the California Trail, the Twin Sisters campsite was within a short hike to Pinnacle Pass, the narrow path that the wagons used to cross over. We meant to hike past the camp up to Pinnacle Pass, where rangers told us we could still see the ruts on the granite where the wagon trains passed. Instead, we stumbled among sagebrush, climbing in and out of peaks and boulders, utterly lost except for our twin sisters' landmarks. Our shoes soaked up the early evening drizzle that was spitting down on us, and more than once, I wondered if we were ever going to find the ruts that Lyle wanted so much to see. "Is that it?" I asked, as we finally found the narrow pass that could only be the passage the wagons must have taken. Along the rock road, two faint indentations ran across the trail, ghosts of more than 200,000 people who stood in the same area we were. "I think that's it," he said, bending down to inspect the maybe 2-foot-long marks. After more than an hour of bushwhacking through the scrub sage and slipping along the sides of the mountains, the marks may have seemed anticlimactic to many. For us, it was a step back in time. Visitors to Idaho who are searching for history should stop at the National Oregon-California Trail Center of Montpelier, Idaho. In addition to being a wealth of information about the history of the trail and filled with artifacts from brave souls, the center has an interactive exhibit where you become part of the Pioneer Wagon Company headed west. You complete the 2,000-mile journey along the Oregon-California Trail in just 1 hour. Rhea Island Crossing State Park, located on the Snake River at Glens Ferry, houses the Glens Ferry Historical Museum and the Oregon Trail History and Education Center, where visitors can learn about pioneer immigrants and Native American history. But if you're on the road, the history of the trails can be found on 2 or 4 wheels. Following the trail, U.S. Interstate 20 through Idaho cuts through some of the state's emptiest spaces, volcanic regions, and looming mountain ranges. But irrigation has altered the land considerably from what the immigrants saw. These days, green crops and even vineyards have replaced the plains of sagebrush. Back in the day, this region was one of the greatest challenges to those on the Oregon Trail. The main Oregon Trail backcountry byway, along I-20, follows the Oregon Trail from the crossing of the Snake River near Glens Ferry to Bonneville Point, southeast of Boise. Oregon Trail ruts are visible along much of this route, and in several places, you can even hike along the Oregon Trail. The total distance of the byway is 102 miles, and it takes about 8 hours to complete the entire route from Boise. In Boise, Idaho's jumping and hip capital city, the Oregon Trail's reserves 77-acre site also boasts wagon ruts that were carved by thousands of wheels between 1843 and 1867. The interpretive sites include stories and remnants of the Oregon Trail and the challenges and experiences travelers faced in the area. As we drove the many highways in Idaho, we made a point to stop at every historical marker we passed. Just south of Boise, on the way to surf down the massive mountains of sand at Bruno Dune State Park, we veered off to see the main Oregon Trail backcountry byway site of Bonneville Point. After traveling through the dry and rough high desert of central Idaho, this point gave the long-suffering immigrants the first glimpse of the Boise River Valley, a green land lined with cottonwood trees and resplendent with lush grass. At the most southeast point of the trail is Bound Creek, a large granite boulder that became known as an immigrant post office. Like Register Rock, immigrants wrote their names in axle grease here, though time has faded many of the names. It was also near here that the travelers braved the Three Island Crossing, one of the most dangerous and lethal of the Snake River crossings. Because of its deadly currents, many immigrants continue down the south side of the river, and ruts are still visible to this day on the bluffs and fields. At Hot Springs Creek, more ruts are visible on the east side of the creek, and beyond that, the Hot Springs location was mentioned in nearly every immigrant diary. Here, hot water gurgling from underground mixed with a cold water stream. Perhaps the first hot bath many of the pioneers had had for weeks. Those springs are no more, however, thanks to modern-day irrigation wells. Not all ruts and remembering. On our sprawling and road-filled journey through Idaho, we also saw sights the immigrants didn't. The eerie volcanic fields of Crater of the Moon National Monument, roughly 3 hours east of Boise, is a weird Lovecraftian landscape filled with yawning craters, deep chasms, and dark lava caves. It's stark and menacing and beautiful all at the same time, and encompassing 750,000 acres along the Great Rift, a 52-mile crack in the Earth's crust. Celebrating its centennial of being named a national monument in 2024, Craters of the Moon is simply otherworldly. I wondered if the immigrants would have thought that they were on another planet if they had stumbled upon this hellish and fascinating landscape. North of Boise, along the Oregon border, we wove along the winding road to Hell's Canyon, the deepest river gorge in North America, before heading north to where the Sawtooth Mountains loom like fangs of some great bear. In Ponderosa State Park, near the boutique tourist town of McCall, we hiked among cattails and deer and giant ponderosa pines. We sipped whiskey among the glassy stairs of an incredible deer mount collection, Native American artifacts, and Ernest Hemingway collections at the Pioneer Saloon in Ketchum, and we lounged in the hot waters of Idaho's many natural hot springs. On our last day, we trekked 10 miles on the Sawtooth Lake Trail outside the historic Stanley, Idaho, to Alpine Lake, a glossy, clear oasis of peaceful views of the scenic peaks of Grand Mogul and Elephant's Birch. Though the pioneers who traveled over the Oregon Trail in the 1840s and 50s rarely settled in Idaho, future pioneers did. Today, the state boasts the highest growth in population of any state in the U.S., though the entire state still only has barely over 1.9 million people total. In those 10 days chasing trails in Idaho, we felt like we only scratched the surface. Next time, we'll hit the snaky roads that lead to the state's wild and untamed Top Hat Wilderness region, where towns are tiny and scattered, and the wolves and moose still rule the land. And yes, there will be a next time. Idaho is too adventurous and beautiful for just one road trip.
Days in the Desert, Words and Photos by Samuel Odio. The truth is more likely to be found at the bottom and the edges of things than at the top or the center. Richard Rohr. Out in the Oregon High Desert, 25 miles of dirt track from the closest asphalt, there lives, at least momentarily, a man by the name of G.K. Malenio. I am uncertain of G.K.'s given name, for he has no driver's license, and his car has no identification other than a tattered Mexican license plate. GK has made this remote public land his home for the last 4 months, surviving winter in one of the coldest regions of the state with only the provisions he was able to fit into or on the roof of his car. The roof is especially useful, as GK also sleeps and cooks in his car, and sleeping and cooking tend to take up precious space in a 90s-era subcompact Volkswagen Beetle. GK will soon be gone, though. A forest ranger stopped by, as they're apt to do on public lands. GK knows the patrol has started a clock, and he needs to move along before the next patrol or the interaction will be less pleasant. GK describes himself as a disabled hermit who goes months without interacting with others and is unable to drive without great exertion and pain. So seeing the ranger is no small event. Never mind the complicating detail that his Mexican license plates are expired and over a decade old. GK has been living nomadically for some time. Born in the United States, GK left the country shortly after college. In 2015, he returned to the U.S. from Sonora, Mexico, to get his paperwork sorted and recuperate, with the goal of becoming a citizen elsewhere. Driving north from Mexico, he landed in the Northern Basin and Range, an arid high plateau that spans four states, where precipitation is scarce and usually comes as snow. 9 years later, he's still here. He can tell I'm questioning his intention to leave the country. I am more American than baseball. America, to me, stands for peace, freedom, and justice for all. But I don't see many Americans here anymore, he shares, as he eases into a desolate, hot spring 40 steps from his campsite. I watch the steam rise as the sun sets over a distant horizon, and I begin to think this man has stories to tell. Perhaps that's always the case when one hasn't spoken for months. The story he wants to tell me is about his injury and miraculous healing on public lands. He talks of a two-decade-long saga. During the first decade, he tried unsuccessfully to convince others, including doctors and his former wife, that he was disabled. After that, he fled society and has spent the last 9 years trying to document and share his recovery. When he describes his injury, he says, "My bones were all going the wrong direction." GK has had a long journey of healing through years of solitary meditation and spiritual practice in the desert, and he imagines a story that will become a best-selling documentary. I struggle to imagine it at all. The story I want to hear about is one of the trials and thoughts of a man who has spent so long in the desert with so little. How do you survive the cold winter, I wonder, knowing in this climate the winter lows average 22 degrees Fahrenheit? How do you access remote places with a two-wheel drive car? What if you have to leave? I asked these questions after spending months agonizing over different portable space heaters for my trip, some costing several thousand dollars. I see no heater in GK's VW. Instead, he has a blanket, kettle, and a small stove. He tells stories of a January so cold he had to break the ice twice or three times a day to keep his only water source, a nearby fresh spring, flowing. I push him on the subject. How do you stay warm? His reply, my matcha keeps me warm. Despite this, he pities my plan to leave after only two nights. I'm spending 40 days solo in the desert, I share. I guess you can call it a vision quest or maybe a midlife crisis, but I plan on making it down to Baja. I'm sure to mention Baja so that GK understands how epic of a road trip this is going to be. I expect a reaction similar to the one I constantly receive from friends back home, one best described as incredulity mixed with admiration and envy. What are you looking for in Mexico that you can't find here, he asks instead. I mutter something about kayaking the Sea of Cortez, trailing off as I slowly recognize I have no real answer. He answers for me, almost rhetorically. All that movement takes tread off your cerebral synapses. Huh? I repeat this sentence out loud, trying to put meaning to the words. Then I think about how I'm going to drive 70 hours on a trip to ostensibly find myself in stillness. GK quickly discerns I'm from a big city. In my itinerary, and my built-out camping rig, he sees me hankering. He says it's what over how instead of how over what. I wonder how to make sense of him and ask him what he means. Hankering is a modern people's problem, he says. Every moment for them is a manifestation of hankering, an embodiment of anxiety. We in modern civilization are in constant search for the what, the next possession, the bucket list item, the external validation. We think the what defines us, our self-worth. We think once we check off all the items on our bucket list, we'll be okay. In reality, what matters isn't the what, it's the how. As he talks, one line catches my attention. This hankering, this search for the what, it's like a twitch you can't control. I think of the many times on this trip, something around me hijacked my attention and purpose. I see dirty laundry and I'm soon getting out the bucket and soap. An unread book reminds me of work not yet done, and soon I'm ruminating on my competence as an employee back home. Then I think of life back in civilization, away from the desert. I think of my phone, helpfully telling me I spend hours on it every day, constantly responding to and triaging the hundreds of notifications it pushes into my attention. All of this I do subconsciously. My behavior is driven by my environment. Twitches. No thought given to the how. I drift back to the conversation. GK, as if sensing my train of thought, quotes a German philosopher. "The hammer shapes the hand," he elaborates. "To stop the obsession over the what, we can't do that, though, through sheer force of will. We must nudge our environment to nudge ourselves. A 1% nudge every day is all we can do, but the change adds up. It compounds." I think about how our tools have shaped our culture and society, how they have shaped our collective wants and desires, how they've shaped our attention span, our tolerance for one another, and our tolerance for different ideas. I wonder, what are these changes compounding to? GK leaves me with a challenge. What if Mexico is a reward? Something you do once you've mastered the how and are worthy. I tell him I don't understand and ask for examples. GK talks about his diet and how he recently added chickpeas after mastering eating only rice and beans. It still doesn't connect for me. He goes on to talk about his wife and how he drove her away with his anger. He talks about his feelings of shame around that and how much he wants a family. He talks about how he's working on himself now, and when the time is right, he'll consider himself worthy to pursue courtship again. As he's talking, I slowly realize there aren't many things I abstain from because I don't consider myself worthy. If I'm going camping, I have to have the perfect setup for it. It doesn't matter if I'm spending more on the gear than the trip. If I'm driving by a fast food joint to find myself craving it, I'll probably indulge. I think about my children and marriage and how my worst moments I can't control bringing frustration and judgment into those relationships. Am I worthy of them? Have I done the work? I'm slowly beginning to wonder, am I the America that GK doesn't recognize? The next day, I pack up and get an early start, saying goodbye to GK and thanking him on the way out. "Try the El Vord Desert," he says, giving me directions to a remote campsite that's 60 miles west and no less beautiful than the one we're at. It's one of the many campsites he knows well, like rooms in a house. As he's sharing the location of this hidden gem, I imagine this man, with so little, might be wealthier than anyone I know. I thank him sincerely and drive off, lost in thought. Why am I on this trip, I wonder? What am I looking for? What is driving me? As I ponder these questions, I look at the intersection ahead of me. To the west is the El Vord Desert and an opportunity to reflect in silence. An opportunity, I realize, to work on the how. 1,500 miles south is Laredo, Mexico. I turn south. A 1% change, it turns out, is all I can do.
Legend has it, Front Runner was conceived between a 1988 Land Cruiser 70 and a 1992 Mercedes-Benz G-Wagon in Botswana by a handful of friends from South Africa with backgrounds in engineering, design, manufacturing, and off-road racing. After suffering through numerous equipment failures on their expeditions around the world, they decided to take their shared passion for vehicle-based adventure travel and dream up new, smart gear and build it stronger than, well, as they put it, stronger than the elephants at the watering hole one click over. Today, Front Runner's products have a well-deserved reputation for quality, intelligent design, and durability. Front Runner's manufacturing facility is located just outside of Johannesburg, South Africa, and features in-house laser cutting, bending, and power coating. If you're seeking tough gear built for adventure, look no further than Front Runner Outfitters.
Stay tuned for Outdoor by Four's Issue 53, highlighting a myriad of stories that will inspire you to step out and explore the world around you. Also, be sure to visit the Outdoor by Four website at www.outdoorx4.com regularly for new tips, reviews, and stories, and join our e-newsletter to stay in the loop on the latest from Outdoor by Four. You can also follow Outdoor by Four and the adventures of our staff and contributors on Instagram and Facebook at @OutdoorX4, on TikTok and YouTube at @OutdoorX4 Magazine, and by following the hashtag OutdoorX4. Until our next issue, we wish each of you the happiest of adventures.